Gee, it's nice to see everyone here today. Welcome to the annual lecture series of the Center for Philosophy of Science. And let me proceed immediately to introduce our speaker, Nancy Cartwright, who is standing here before us. She has a very long and, might I say, happy connection with the University of Pittsburgh, having taken a Bachelor's of Science in Mathematics here from Pitt, then went away somewhere else, Illinois, to do a PhD, then came back and was a fellow at the Center for Philosophy of Science, in fact, twice. She was a fellow the year that I was a fellow, and I might say those were truly heady days. In those days, I had more hair. You had blue hair, and I'm still trying to figure out which is the more incredible thought. Anyway, so after her stay here at the center, she went on to fame and fortune. You had, in fact, Nancy, already written How the Laws of Physics Lie at that point. You still had much more to write: Nature's Capacities and Their Measurements, the book on Otto Neurath, The Double World. And you also received many wonderful awards. Of course, the MacArthur Award, you didn't want to give that one back, no? Okay. And has moved through a number of prestigious appointments. And she is presently the chair of the Center for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science and professor of philosophy at the Department of... You have the biggest business card in the world, right? And the Department of Philosophy, Logic and Scientific Method. Oh, sorry, it's a formality. We need to do this at the LSE. And she is also a professor of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. And she will speak today on the topic of hunting causes and using them.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be back in Pittsburgh, and I do want to take the occasion to thank the center and its affiliates and my teachers and the University of Pittsburgh in general for having been extremely helpful and generous to me over the years, and it's really great to be here. I gather I'm supposed to put this on, but I'm not sure where. Does that work? Am I going to have this thing there? Is that okay? The talk today has a subtitle, Where is the Theory in Our Theories of Causality? And I wanted to give you something that was finished rather than one of the, well, I mean, my finished papers are probably half-baked, but one of the ones that's officially half-baked. This is the topic, and it is The Hunting Causes and Using Them is a title of a book I've just finished with Cambridge Press. Causality, as you know, is a hot topic today, both in philosophy and in economics. I'm doing a lot of work in economics nowadays, or philosophy of economics. There are approaching a dozen different theories of causality on offer. Few are reductionist. They do not embrace the Hume program of replacing causation by something weaker, but all claim to be informative theories to tell us what are the central characterizing features of causation. Those are sort of quotes from people, that the central characterizing features, informative theories. Okay. So all claim to tell us what are the central characterizing features of causation. And here's a list of just some of these theories and some of their major proponents. These are ones I've worked on, so that's how they got on the list. There are others as well. So we don't need to go through the list, just so that you see there really is a long list, and it's not all of them. Now, what is my worry about the theory in these theories of causality? Well, rather than explaining my worry directly, as I now see it, I shall instead describe a web of thought that brought me to it. And in the end, I don't think that you need to share many of the views I'm going to describe along the way in order to share my concerns, but I think that working through them with me will make the problem more vivid and provide it with a kind of texture and depth that might otherwise be missing. That is, if I just told you the problem, that lecture would be over, you'd see the problem, and we could all go home, and I just thought it was a great breakthrough for me to see this problem, so I want to sort of string it out a bit, so that we'll have to make a lecture. There are 7 interwoven strands that make up this web of thought. And I'm going to talk about each of them. There they are. And again, you don't need to actually understand them because I'm going to go through them one at a time. The first is causation, one word, many things. Generally, many of you may know this, or at least those of you who've known me for a while, when I open my eyes and look around me, I see a dappled world, plotted and pieced, not one homogeneous sweeping plane. Now, this tendency to see a dappled world rather than a homogeneous plane has been reinforced by my studies of causality over the last few years, which lead me to the conclusion that causation is not one monolithic concept, nor is there one single thing, the causal relation, that underpins our correct uses of that concept. There are a variety of different kinds of relations picked out by the abstract term causes, and a variety of different, correct uses of the term for a variety of different purposes, with little of substantial content in common. The variety of theories of causal law on offer, usually I only talk about theories of causal law, not theories about singular causation, which are a whole complication that I don't know how to deal with, and since I'm always working in sort of in the sciences, are less pressing than if I were doing sort of legal things. Now, the variety of theories of causal law on offer provides one of the major reasons in favor of this plurality view. Each seems to be a good treatment of the paradigms that are used to illustrate it, but each has counterexamples and problems. Generally, the counterexamples are provided by paradigms from some one or another of the other theories of causality. Usually, in these cases, we can see roughly why the one treatment is good for the one kind of example, but not for the other, and the reverse. That's usually what we can do. Sometimes, we can do better. We can give an explicit characterization of the kind of system of causal laws that the treatment presupposes, and in the nicest cases, we can prove a kind of representation theorem. And this is what I think we should always be aiming at, and it's the kind of thing that Clark does in his work. Okay, so Bayes' nets are a good case. Okay. Oops, what happened to this transparency there? I have a little piece of paper for the transparency, but I don't seem to have the transparency. Oh, there we are. Bayes' nets are a good case. A Bayes' net account of what causality is. The reason I put Spohn here is because Spohn is one person who says very explicitly causality just is what's demonstrated in a Bayes' net. Right? And I don't know that other people make such a strong claim about identifying causality with what's in a Bayes' net. So a Bayes' net account of what causality is, of the kind Wolfgang Spohn offers, is provably correct for a system of causal laws over a causally sufficient set of quantities for which the three Bayes' nets postulates hold, plus some other assumptions, the assumption that if any two factors are probabilistically dependent, then either one of them causes the other or they have a common cause. Anyway, the point is that a Bayes' net account of what causality is provably correct for systems that satisfy this set of assumptions. That's a kind of representation theorem. Similarly, I prove a representation theorem that shows that for systems of laws that satisfy the axioms of what I call a linear deterministic system, so if you've got the axioms of a linear deterministic system, I don't want to show you them, but if you have those axioms, James Woodward's account of level invariance, his level invariance account of causation, always yields correct results. So that's another example of a representation theorem. Now, if this account is correct, my account of causation, then we have a variety of different kinds of causal systems, and what we indicate by saying that one quantity causes another varies according to what characterizes the different systems. Now, this makes a problem for methods. So I want to go on and think about method. Metaphysics and methods should march hand in hand. If we have an account of what causation is, then we ought to be able to explain why our methods for licensing causal claims are good methods for finding just the thing we say causality is. If our account of causation does not mesh with our best methods for finding out about causes, something has gone wrong on one side or the other. Now, we are used to thinking, or at least I always was, and I think most of us are, we are used to thinking of causation as one thing, with many different methods to learn about it. Life is more complicated if we accept, as I have come to, that there are different kinds of causation with different characterizing features. We must then face up to the question, which methods are appropriate for which kinds of causation? You know, before you could think you were just studying causation and you've got a bunch of different methods and you didn't have to think anymore about it. But now I've got lots of different kinds of causation, and then we've got all these methods and they better get matched up if, okay. So that's a kind of question that most of us haven't been explicitly addressing. Now, in fact, so we have to face up to the question, which methods are appropriate for which kinds of causation? Now, in fact, for many of our philosophic theories of causality, the question is not so difficult, since the theories themselves are almost read off from one method or another. Let's look at one of them. It's a kind of Baudelaireized version I'm going to give you just to get the idea. But consider Patrick Soupy's probabilistic theory of causality, which forms the basis as well for Bazinet's theories. So the probabilistic theory of causation tells you that C causes E in some special kind of situation, Ki, if and only if C raises the probability of E in that situation. And my view is that Ki in this case is a state description over a complete set of confounding factors. But you know, exactly how to specify that is controversial. Now, that's the theory. Soupy's theory of what causality is, or Soupy's theory of what causality is after it's been adjusted for counterexamples and things that people made. So that's Soupy's theory of what causality is. And then what's the method? Well, it's just a standard method that social sciences use all the time. They stratify on the KIs and then look for a correlation. So C causes E is licensed if C and E are probabilistically dependent once we've stratified on a complete set of confounding factors. So there's this real close connection between the method and the metaphysics. They're almost just the same. Now, for varieties of causation where methods are not so immediately apparent, clearly it is a pressing matter to find appropriate methods and to show that they are appropriate. It's not just finding them, but being able to explain why this method is appropriate to that concept of causation. Okay. Now, I want to go on to representation. Handsome is as handsome does, which is one of my mother's favorite expressions. I argue, as you've just been hearing, borrowing an expression of Maria Carla Galavati, I argue for plurality and causality. But it would still be awfully nice to find something in common. We do actually use one word to cover all these different kinds of systems, so I look. So I look for something in common. Is there not something in virtue of which it is correct to call all these different kinds of relations or all those different theories? Why are they called theories of causality? And they each one of them seem kind of plausibly called that. Well, here's a proposal. Rather than looking for one special relation in the world that legitimates representing them as causal, look instead for some unified features of the representations themselves. And so I've said there were all these theories of causality. They were each of them suited to a special kind of system. And we represent those kinds of systems in a certain way, like linear deterministic systems. Maybe we can find something that's in common in the representations. Now, clearly, under this proposal, we would not want to be thinking in terms of some kind of Fido-Fido or correspondence theory of representation. So I have been thinking instead of a theory of scientific representation championed by Mauricio Suarez. Whoops. A scientific representation should allow us to make inferences about the system represented. Now, whether or not this is a good starting point for thinking of scientific representation in general, it might be a help in thinking about what makes it right to call a variety of different kinds of relations all causal. So that's the idea, and I've explored a lot of different kinds of patterns of inference that you might make. But the obvious starting point is, it's one I've got discouraged about, but it seems to me there is an obvious starting point. The reason for being optimistic about the suggestion is that there is a certain kind of inference that has always been stressed as central to the notion of causation. And that's what I want to turn to next. And the next section is called Causal Laws and Effective Strategies. And we don't have a slide, but you don't actually need to have a slide with that written on it. The idea that causes allow us to affect the world has always been part of our thinking about the notion of cause. It is at the core of our current manipulation theories, as well as some invariance theories. It is probably the dominant idea about causation in economics right now, and it was right at the fore when talk of causation first reappeared, defying positivist prohibition, as witnessed by the title, Causal Laws and Effective Strategies, of my very first paper on causality. The idea suggested by this, in combination with the inference-based approach to representation, is that representing a set of relations as causal should allow us to make some kinds of inferences that show how to use causes as strategies for producing effects. Is something like this possible? Well, let me start with some theories of causality where such inferences hold center place. And now we really do need the, we can maybe do one. Yeah, you want to get a bulb. I can write on the board, of course. It'd just take a little longer. Kevin Hoover. Kevin Hoover is an economist at UC Davis. He has a master's degree in HPS and came from Cambridge with Mary Hesse. You know, Kevin Hoover, in Causality and Macroeconomics, distinguishes between quantities we control directly and those we do not. So you think about, we're supposed to be thinking now about manipulation. We're supposed to be thinking about this idea, right, that calling something causal is has something to do with it allowing us to make some kinds of inferences that show how to use causes as strategies for producing effects. So Kevin Hoover has got a really good theory of causality that does just that. So Hoover distinguishes between quantities we control directly and those we do not. His aim is to characterize the causal relations among the latter using the concept of direct control. So the ones we don't control directly, he's going to try and explain or give a theory of what it means to say one of those causes another. He then takes the following as the central characterizing feature of causality. How do we get this up? Here? Yeah. The Kevin Hoover one is easy, but when we get to... Okay. So what Kevin says is X, I'm going to use this arrow for causes Y, if and only if anything we do to affect X... Anything we do, sorry, to fix X. Anything we do to fix X affects Y, but not vice versa. Now, if that's what causality is, it is a primitive notion, direct control. But if that's, and again, as I said, these are supposed to be informative theories about central characterizing features of causality, not reductive definitions, and that's obvious here. Now, if that's what causality is, which is what Hoover, coming out of his economics background, his elaborate definitions, but they boil down to this. If this is what causality is, then the inference from X causes Y to we can influence Y by fixing X is built right into the metaphysics. Now, similarly, for econometrician David Hendry. So David Hendry tells us that causes are super exogenous. Now, super exogenous means weak exogeneity plus invariance. So I've got to explain weak exogeneity and this invariance, which is why it'd be nice to have the machine. This is the only complicated part at all of the talk, and it's where... Okay. Sorry. Thank you. You could put it here. Leave that one, and I'll just move over. Yeah. Okay. So rather than my writing it on the board, I think it's probably worth just waiting to. Remember that causes are super exogenous factors relative to their putative effects, and super exogeneity is weak exogeneity plus invariance. I'm going to explain that. I've lost my sheet of paper in the meantime. I can just look here, though, to tell you. So weak exogeneity, you know that you can, if you have a joint probability of X and Y, and we've written explicitly the parameters that it depends on, and it depends on, say, some set of parameters, beta, union, gamma. I've just divided the parameters. They could all be in beta, they could all be in gamma. I'm doing that because in a moment we want to divide them. You can always write the joint probability as a conditional probability times a marginal. What you can always do would have the same parameters. I mean, this would be, you'd have the same parameters on the right-hand side as you would on the left-hand sides, because it's always talking about when you have the same distribution, you can always write it this way. Now, you have X is weakly exogenous to Y if the parameters of the marginal distribution of X have no cross restraints with the parameters of the conditional distribution of Y on X. So if you can really factor the parameters into two sets, and they can take any values together, so that really the two parts of the distribution are separable in that sense, you say you've got what's defined as the concept of weak exogeneity. It's relevant, you see, because what we're doing here is reminiscent of probabilistic theory of causality. We're looking at the conditional probability of the effect, the putative effect on the cause. Okay. Now, I sure wish I had found page 93, but... super exogeneity says that in addition, the conditional distribution... This one is invariant to interventions that change the parameters of the marginal distribution. Okay? If we begin mucking around with the marginal distribution, okay, we have super exogeneity if this distribution is invariant under those changes. And the idea is that's nice for causation, because if X causes Y, you think of jiggering around with the probability of X. If you like Y's, then you try and get more X's and expect to get more Y's. So you jigger around with the probability of X, and what you assume is... That's what technologically today. What you assume is that the probability, the conditional probability stays the same so that you can continue to use it. Is it still working?
Yeah.
Okay. So that you can continue to use it. So super exogeneity says that that's what happens. That well, you can jigger around with the parameters of gamma, the parameter gamma, and beta doesn't change. Okay. Now suppose then, I just told you a little story about causation, but think about this. Why do you need this additional invariance condition? Well, suppose that X is weakly exogenous with respect to Y, and you do think of changing the distribution of X in order to affect the distribution of Y. It may seem, just from looking at the conditions for weak exogeneity, it may seem that we can predict the outcome from the formula for the conditional distribution. But that is not so. Changing gamma, that's changing this, changes the joint probability distribution. You can't have the same joint probability distribution as you did before if you change gamma. So changing gamma changes the joint probability distribution, and there is nothing that ensures that the new conditional distribution will still be the same. In the original distribution, beta and gamma may have no dependencies, but that does not show what happens if the distribution is changed. That's why Hendry adds the constraint X causes Y only if the parameters beta of the conditional distribution stay fixed as we vary the parameters gamma of the marginal distribution. Now, again, an inference about use follows immediately from the very notion of cause. Right? It just, once you've defined cause this way, you can see the immediate connection with cause. Now, can we do this in general? Recall that was my hope. The project I was looking at was this one. Representing a relation as causal allows some kinds of inferences about use. Now, unfortunately, this hope is not supported by the other theories of causality on offer. To see this vividly, I want to consider James Woodward's manipulation invariance theory of causality, a case where we might expect the connection to be immediate, just as in the case of Hoover and Hendry's theories. Okay, so the next is hunting causes versus using them. Okay. It is often supposed that the gold standard for hunting causes, i.e. for ascertaining causal relations, is the ideal Galilean experiment. In this kind of experiment, you might notice I also said it's often supposed. I just don't want to be anybody to go away thinking I endorse this, because it's one of the things I argue against elsewhere. But it's often supposed that the gold standard for hunting causes is the ideal Galilean experiment. In this kind of experiment, we vary the cause, holding fixed all other sources of variation of the putative effect, and we look to see if the effect varies in train. This is just what James Woodward uses to characterize causation. Now, let's see if I've got a slide here. Okay. Woodward considers situations in which the putative effect Y is a function of the putative cause X, okay, so that they covary. Now, if X is to be correctly said to cause Y, then he demands the strong condition that X be able to vary independently of all other sources of variation in Y, as we should like to see in a Galilean experiment. You can't do the Galilean experiment if every time you try to vary the putative cause, all the other confounding factors vary along with it. So the demand that makes a Galilean experiment possible, Woodward builds right into his definition of causation. X doesn't cause Y unless it's possible to do a Galilean experiment to find out. Okay? But that's not, and that condition is called modularity, that it's possible to vary the putative cause without varying anything else. But he also requires that the functional relation between X and Y, this is what matters to me now in this talk, he also requires that the functional relation between X and Y stay the same across variations in X that keep fixed the other causes of Y. Okay. This ensures that Y will covary with X in a Galilean experiment as required if X is to be judged a cause of Y from the experiment. And that second condition is called invariance. So he's got both modularity and invariance as his characterizing features of causation. So we've got Woodward here saying that given that Y is a function of X, then X causes Y if and only if the modularity condition is satisfied. X can be varied independently of other causes. And invariance, that the functional relation stays the same as X is varied. Okay. Now, this might, and he does call it, it might be reasonably be called a manipulation account. But it is very different. That's what's wrong. I'm sorry. We have all these problems. There's a big puddle of water. Because when we move the There was a glass of water under the lectern, and when we moved it over, it spilled the water, and I was actually getting a mild shock. And I was wondering, I'm sorry, this is distracting us from the idea. I was wondering why I had this kind of tingling in my feet. Okay. At least I didn't, you know, I didn't pass out or anything. This must be a very mild bit of a, okay. Let me explain why I don't think this is a manipulation theory of causality, or why it's not the kind of manipulation account that the economists give. Well, I think the economists are giving an account of real manipulation, how to use causes, and Woodward is not. And it's huge. You're not going to be able to get it up with that. That's why I don't mind standing in it as long as the electricity isn't in it. Okay. So, Woodward's theory of causality licenses counterfactuals about what would happen if the cause were to vary in a very special way, a way that is not what we would normally be envisaging for either policy or technology. The variation that he demands is just the kind we need if we want to test a causal claim, to hunt for causes, but not the kind we expect to implement when we try to use them. The same is true for many of the other accounts. Recall that many of the others are almost read off some one or another method for establishing causal claims. Correlatively, like Woodward's account, they give little guidance about what we can do with a causal claim once we are entitled to it. This observation is true almost universally. Okay. I've got a transparency here. Where are they? Yes, here. Sorry. This observation is true almost universally across our list of causal theories. Okay. If we went back and I put down the 11 causal theories I listed or whatever there were, if you look at them, they are in essence either language entry rules. They tell us when it is correct to label relations causal, or they are language exit rules. They tell us what inferences we can draw from the label. So this raises for me twin concerns. Okay. These twin concerns down here. What is the use of causes characterized from a hunting methodology? So if you take one of those theories of causality, that practically reads off the metaphysics from the methods for the language entry methods, how do you know how you can use the information once you've got it? On the other hand, how do we hunt causes when they are characterized entirely in terms of their use? Okay. So those are the twin concerns I arrived at from doing this study. And I want to go on and talk about, remember I told you one of the earlier sections was titled Causality, Metaphysics, and Methods, and I had a project for years called, 3 years, called Causality, Metaphysics, and Methods, and it never occurred to me or anyone else to say, how come you don't have use in there, right? So now, causality, metaphysics, methods, and use. So I have briefly sketched the first of my twin problems in referring to Woodward's manipulation invariance account. You know, how do you use causes if causes are just read off? If the metaphysics, if a cause really is just one of those, what one of those theories says that reads it off from the method, how can you use it? And that was, you saw the illustration of that in Woodward's case. The same holds for Lewis-style counterfactual accounts. They provide an elaborate procedure for deciding when we can attach the label cause. But then what? There's nothing more in the account that allows us to move anywhere from that, nothing that licenses any inference for use. The second concern can be readily seen in Milton Friedman's famous arguments in favor of hugely idealized models in economics. Models, he urges, should be judged by the correctness of their results in the domain under investigation, not by the correctness of their assumptions. So, like the economists' accounts of causality I discussed above, for Friedman, models are geared to use, Right? A good model is just one. That's how you judge that it's good. It just gives you the correct result. Okay? But this very fact restricts their usefulness. The very fact that models, Friedman models, are geared to use restricts their usefulness. The most useful models are ones that we can first legitimate by some independent means and then use to make predictions about new matters. On Friedman's account, all there is to the acceptability of the model is that it gives correct predictions about the matters we are interested in. And that's just what we cannot know about the model beforehand, if our point in using it is to gain confidence in those predictions. Similarly, for Hoover's account of causality, what we should like is to have an independent reason for thinking that X causes Y, then use that to infer that manipulating X will affect Y. But for Hoover, that is just what it is for X to cause Y, so we cannot establish the causal relation first and then use it later for policy predictions, or he gives no information in the that follows from the idea of what causality is for doing that. What we see from the twin concerns that I raise is that in all the theories of causation listed, the metaphysics is too thin. It is geared either to hunting causes or to using them, but not to both. My own earlier project, Causality, Metaphysics and Methods, missed this point. Yes, the metaphysics of causality must be tied to methods on the one hand, but it must equally be tied to use on the other. And then here's a sort of lesson. Our philosophic treatment of causation must make clear why the methods we use for testing causal claims provide a good warrant for the uses to which we put those claims. I don't think, yes, that's on this. Okay. So the last section is, where is the theory and our theories of causality? Okay. Considering Hendry in this light raises yet another issue. Weak exogeneity is a concept having to do with statistical inference. Remember, Hendry said causation is super exogeneity, that is, weak exogeneity plus invariance. Okay. Now, weak exogeneity is a concept having to do with statistical inference, estimating what a distribution is. This has little apparent connection with causality. But Hendry's attention to the conditional distribution of Y on X in his account of X causes Y is reminiscent, as I said, of the probabilistic theory of causality. So he's got something like a probabilistic theory. I don't want to go into this, but something like a probabilistic theory of causality starts out with weak exogeneity. Then he adds on top an invariance condition. Okay. What is disappointing from the point of view of the metaphysics of causality is that the invariance condition is added on. And it is what does the work of licensing predictions for use, though any special features of the thing that is itself invariant. Any kind of formula that allows us to predict what we want to know and that holds true across the variations we envisage will do. It need not have any of the other kinds of characteristics that are in the cluster we usually associate with causality, and characteristics like increase in probability of the effect on the cause, space-time connection, asymmetry of the cause-effect relation, existence of a mechanism, etc., etc., etc. Now, this is the point that Sandra Mitchell makes about the notion of scientific law. For use in prediction, we do not need a claim that holds universally, nor, it seems, do we need anything that satisfies any of our usual accounts of what it is to be a causal law. We only need a claim that holds across the range of situations in which we will use it for prediction. Sometimes the same point seems to be urged by Woodward, too. He seems to argue that invariance, and just invariance, if you look at other points in his book on it, across the required, possibly highly limited range of envisaged uses is what matters. We might call that causation, then. But then he doesn't really embrace this. He insists later on the Galilean manipulation account of causation that I described, which is not geared to practical use. Beysnet's methods make a considerable advance here. I think, for instance, of the manipulation theorem of Spirti's, Gleamore, and Shinas, and presumably there's more Clark's going to tell me about, that computes facts. So what this theorem does is it computes facts about the joint probability of variables after manipulation from facts about their distribution before plus facts recorded in the causal graph. So that's the kind of thing I think of. It computes facts. You've got a theorem. It tells you how to compute the joint probability afterwards, or facts about it, from facts about the distribution before plus the causal graph. Another example is Pearl's thick book on counterfactuals. I worry, though, that both cases are still too close to the strategy I ascribed to Hendry, the add-on strategy. Bayes' nets characterize causality in terms of the three axioms I cited, the chief of which is the causal Markov condition. But how important is the causal Markov condition to our ability to predict facts about the probability distribution after manipulation from knowledge of the causal relations plus the probability distribution before? I do not think it can be too important. Consider, for example, what I call, and again, I'm not going to lay all this out for you, but consider, for example, what I call epistemically convenient systems with probability measures. For these, we can define a very close analog of the Spirides, Gleamore, Shinas concept of manipulation, including, as they do, the assumption that the causal relations are invariant under manipulation. So if I stick in the invariance condition, that they stick in as well. Okay. Now, systems like this need not satisfy, my epistemically convenient systems, need not satisfy the causal Markov condition. Yet, I can derive results about what happens to the joint distributions under manipulation in these kinds of systems, just as we can when the causal Markov condition is satisfied. In both cases, most of the work in deriving the relevant results is done not by the axioms of the system, the ones that sort of were supposed to have something to do with causality, but the work is really done by the very restricted notion of manipulation that is used. And the manipulations involved in these theorems are like Woodward's, or those miracle manipulations of David Lewis. They're the kinds of manipulations we should like to make in a Galilean experiment, not the kind we envisage for policy, where many things may be expected to change at once, including some of the causal principles by which the system operates. So do I have a... I want to make sure... Yes. Yes, sorry, that was what I just said. The work in deriving the relevant results is done not by the axioms, especially, but by the restricted notion of manipulation. And that's the manipulations involved are these funny Galilean ones. They're not the ones that you'd use in real life when all sorts of things change at once, including sometimes some of the other causal laws in the situation. Okay. More generally, okay, I should have another transparency for that. Sorry, this one's small because I wanted to get it all on one page. More generally, all the cases that I know where we have counterfactual inferences or manipulation theorems that can be proven from a particular system of causal principles all work in the same way. So it's a rather complicated way they work. But the idea is you're going to try and draw use inferences from the axioms for your system. So you characterize causation in some way, and then you derive some theorems about use from them. And how do those proofs work? Well, first, a set of relations are postulated that satisfy some set of constraints taken to be sufficient to characterize them as causal relations. So if you're a Bayes' nets person, postulate a set of relations that satisfy the Bayes-Nets axioms. If you're me, you studying linear deterministic systems, you postulate a different set of axioms. But a set of relations are postulated that satisfy some set of constraints that you're happy are sufficient to characterize these relations as causal. Second, manipulations are taken to create a new closely related system. The new systems are defined by two clauses. The first describes what is to change, like the value of the putative cause, and the second states a set of things that do not change, like the values of other variables or other causes, and all the other specified relations except that by which the manipulated quantity is produced. Then the counterfactual consequence is calculated in the new system. So that's essentially how all of these schemes work. You start out with an old system, you write down a new system. There are these rules for how you write down the new system from the old. Okay. Now, what is striking about this is that the constraints that... let's see if I've got another one. Thank you. Okay. What is striking about this is that the constraints that justify labeling the system of relations as causal seem to have little role to play. What matters is that there is a system of relations, say equations, that allow us to solve for a given result. Then we're giving a recipe for making very specific changes to produce a new set of equations that also allows us to solve for the result in question. The solvability of the two systems plus the rule for getting from one to the other is what does the job, not any of the constraints that make it a causal system in the first place. So what in the end does causation have to do with policy counterfactuals, manipulation, or effective strategies? Well, I have been hoping for something more, something that shows why our methods should warrant causal claims with practical strategy implications. And I wanted something of substance that does so. It's not enough for a metaphysics of causality to adopt just the add-on strategy, to be simply a union of a language entry rule and a language exit rule. What we should be looking for, I think, is a theory of causality, in much the same way as we have a theory of the electron. The account itself should combine with other chunks of knowledge to imply both the language entry and the language exit moves, rules. Okay, conclusion. There's a one-paragraph conclusion, and then I'll make a suggestion. Okay. The conclusion is, when it comes to theories of causal law, I have urged that we have on offer not a plurality of competing theories, but rather a host of theories, each appropriate to one of a large plurality of different kinds of causal laws. That's my plurality and causality line. That's what I've been urging for a long time, 10 years, I guess, or more. I now worry that this was too generous. I mean, the claim that we had a large variety of theories of causation, each of which was adequate to a certain kind of causal system. I now worry that was too generous. Rather than a plurality of theories, we do not have any theories at all. Okay. Now, I'm going to add just one closing thought. That's the conclusion of the paper. It's all I'm going to argue for. But I would like to make a suggestion. I close with a hypothesis to think about. Bertrand Russell maintained that there are no causal claims in physics, as we know. Many of us have urged the contrary. Physics is rife with causal claims. For instance, Einstein and Enfeld's claim, forces cause motions. Gravitational forces cause motions along the line of action. Electromagnetic forces cause actions parallel to the line of action. Okay, that's one example. If so, then what we have in each of the specific domains of physics are theories about that domain, theories that contain content-rich causal claims, forces cause motions, or gravity, gravitational mass, masses attract each other, massive bodies attract each other. Obviously, the same could be said across the sciences. So perhaps we should find our lead here. And that may be actually the best way I now think to think of elaborated systems of axioms. Maybe our whole enterprise is misplaced. Perhaps we should be seeking not theories of causality, but rather causal theories of the world, and our philosophic enterprise is misplaced by trying to characterize causality rather than just admitting that there are rich causal claims and trying to understand one by one the different causal theories of the world. So, thank you.